And as I said, the nice thing about walking meditation, you end up where you started. Just like life. Just goes round and round. When you get born, you have to wear nappies. You get no hair, no teeth. And that's what happens when you get old as well. You wet your pants, you got no hair, no teeth. So just like life, you end up where you started off, not knowing anything. You forget everything you ever learned. So anyway, the walking meditation. You walk at your natural pace. Not slow, not fast, just natural. And I mentioned, I think the last time we had a retreat on here, there's people said, Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, there are zombies in Jhana Grove. Because everybody was going very slowly. It's not zombie meditation. It is walking. So walk naturally, start at the very beginning. Usually put your gaze 2 meters in front of you, eyes open, so you're not going to bang into the wall, you're not going to trip over or bump into other people, you know, just for insurance purposes, we want to make sure you're safe. And so keep 2 meters in front so you know where you're walking to, it gives you a sense of security and safety. And you start walking and you put your attention not on your breathing, you put your attention on the movement of your feet and your legs. So you know if the left foot is moving or the right foot is moving, instead of thinking about the meaning of life or where you're going to do and what you're going to go. So where you're going to go, what you're going to do when you leave here. So just be aware of the movement of the feet. And little questions you can ask yourself, what part of your foot leaves the ground first? Is it the ball of your foot or your toe or your heel? What part leaves the ground first of all? What part of your foot leaves the ground last? And when it goes up, does it go up vertically, or go backwards a little bit, or forwards a little bit? How does your foot actually move? And just to become aware of as many sensations as you can of just a natural movement of the foot called walking. What part of your foot meets the ground first? What last? And can you notice when your weight of your body transfers onto that foot, just completed the step, so the next foot, the next leg can move up. So become aware of all the different movements of the feet, like a dancer when you're doing the walking meditation. You get to the end of the path and you turn around and you keep on going. What's happening there is your awareness is in the present moment. So you no past, no future, otherwise you forget what you're doing. And you soon become aware of incredible numbers of feelings, what it's like to actually walk. It's actually getting your attention into your body instead of into your head, thinking about all sorts of different things. And after a short while, you get very peaceful. And as many people who have difficulty doing sitting meditation have a wonderful time doing walking meditation, simply because you've got your eyes open, even though you're focusing on the floor, because you've got your eyes open, you don't tend to get sleepy. And because you're feeling the sensations in your feet, you don't go into the past or the future, because the sensations in your body only happen now. They don't usually leave a residue, which means you have to be in the present moment. You're focusing on a very simple part of the body and you get very peaceful and have a wonderful time. So you see people doing walking meditation, that's what they're supposed to be doing. And again, you walk at your natural pace. It's not, don't try and be fast. Don't try and be slow. In the zombie meditation techniques, you see people in there and they're competing on who can walk the slowest. That's really crazy people. So just do natural walking as you normally walk and just be mindful of your feelings in your legs. And just do it as long as you really want. After a while, you start to feel just so peaceful and happy doing this. You can walk for a long period of time. And if you can get the nice experience, because you've been walking for 10 or 15 minutes or half an hour, you know, you're looking there and you're not really doing the walking. The body's doing the walking yourself. You don't need to give any more instructions. It becomes totally automatic. You're walking. And it's great to have that experience of, you know, I'm not giving any orders anymore. Just the body walks, turns around, goes back again, just like you're not there. Now that's a really cool thing to get in walking meditation. So any questions about the walking meditation? So give it a try. If you get a sore bottom and you're getting frustrated doing the sitting meditation, try the walking meditation. Dear Ajahn, where's the questions you asked tonight? I'll put it upside down so I get the last night's questions first. Dear Ajahn, according to the Vinaya, that's the monk's rules, is it okay to give dried food, canned food, uncooked rice to the monks on alms round? A forest tradition in Thailand said it was against the Vinaya, while others encouraged us to gather food for the poor or disaster victims with great respect. If it is gathering food for others, of course it's okay for the monk to collect all those things for other people. The only thing is, we can't collect food and store it ourselves. That's the only rule for monks. So I can't get really nice food today. I'm not quite sure about tomorrow, so I'll keep some of the stuff which I like today until tomorrow. You can't do that. So everything has to be, what you eat today, you eat today. What you eat tomorrow, you eat tomorrow. And you can't store anything up. Because monks are supposed to be simple, not storing anything at all. That's our little rule there. We're not allowed to store. You're allowed to store, so in our monk's quarters, you've got all sorts of stuff there in the fridge and other stuff, but I can't touch that unless you offer it again tomorrow. And I can't ask you. If you forget to offer something, I can't say, Ananda, you forgot the baked beans. I can't say that. All I can do is actually look at you and say... We can't actually say anything like that. But if it's like dried food, canned food, uncooked rice, and if that is, for some poor people, then that's fine. But, it shouldn't really be for yourself, because it's supposed to be cooked rice and cooked food or something like that. Then you can use that. Canned food, sometimes you have. I remember sometimes on alms round, when I went into Thailand on Tudong, all you got, was sticky rice and a can of sardines. And that was your meal for one day. So that's okay, because it's already cooked. Trouble is, open the thing, because you haven't got a knife, and that's the only thing you can eat. You've just got rice. And it's amazing when you're really greedy, and you really want something, just how difficult it is to open the can. So I remember that a couple of times. But yeah, it's dried food, canned food, uncooked rice. It's okay for the monks on alms round, but they shouldn't really store it themselves. So if it's for other people, fine. Is that okay? Ajahn, in meditation we let go of the past and the future, but I like to fantasize in it. Is it enjoyable? How to stop it? It's very easy. Because there was one monk in Thailand, he had the same problem. He always liked to fantasize, sexual fantasy. Let's make it quite clear what you think about fantasize. So he went to see Ajahn Chah and he said, I've got this big problem. Every time I meditate, I've got all these big sexual fantasies. Can you please tell me how to solve that problem? He said, easy, Ajahn said. You've got to follow my instructions. So what are they? He said, next time you give a talk, get up there and tell all the lay people who've been feeding you for years what you've been thinking about when you've been meditating. Let them know. And then you soon stop. So whoever asked that question, could you please write down your sexual fantasy with your name on the bottom, and I will read it out in tomorrow morning's talk. And I guarantee after that you will stop. And I'd also guarantee, if I promise I'm going to read out your sexual fantasy tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, I'm sure people who haven't got up for the talk yet will come. For sure. Now, like sometimes. There was really, I won't say who his name is, quite a famous monk. Well known anyway. And he was, he said, sometimes you've got to be careful also, because some monks can read your mind. And he was staying with one of these monks. And they would meditate for 2 hours every morning before alms round. And sometimes meditating for 2 hours is such hard work. And so one day, just out of frustration, he decided to have a sexual fantasy instead. And he said the time went so peacefully, so quickly, no aches and pains in the body, until the bell went. He said, oh God, I wonder if my teacher has found out. And he was so paranoid, especially when the teacher walked right up to him and looked at him. The teacher knew what he had been doing. But the advice the teacher gave was absolutely beautiful. He didn't scold him. He just said, you've been wasting 2 hours of your time. That's what it was. It wasn't sort of, you bad monk, get out of here. It was just like, it was a waste of time. And that's a very beautiful. So if you have a fantasy or whatever, it's just wasting time. You're not really developing yourself. And you know, all these fantasies, the reason why you can fantasize is because you can make it exactly the way you want it. It's not like real life, is it? You know, in fantasy, you find a nice partner and you live happily ever after. In real life, argument, trouble. In a fantasy, your girlfriend has no pimples. In real life, it's not like that. So you're just wasting time going into things which just don't exist. And this is the problem. It means you're not getting into reality. You're deluding yourself. And sometimes people have those fantasies first in their head and then they try and live them out. And they realize that, you know, it doesn't work. You know, in real life, you know, husbands, wives, girlfriends, boyfriends, even sex, it's not quite the same as in a fantasy. And you get very disappointed and frustrated. So remember, just forget the fantasies and go for real life. A fantasy is a lie. And you're living a life of lying to yourself about what the world is really like. So come to truth. If you want to be wise, you have to give them up and come to truthfulness. And if it's not the sexual fantasies, sometimes people have heroic fantasies. Being Superman or Superwoman. Or, you know, you're playing a sports match and you win the goal, or you score the goal which wins the World Cup for Norway. Or whatever it is, you know, your fantasy, as someone says, in your fantasy, you're always the hero. But then, it's really crazy stuff. In real life, you're not like that. I remember that monk who said, you know, about his sexual fantasies. He said that, well, he was in the Vietnam War, and he said he was a helicopter pilot, and he got shot down one day over the jungles, you know, by the Viet Cong. This was, you know, real war stuff. And so he remembered what he'd seen in the movies, John Wayne, in those days. So on his helicopter, he was a pilot, he had another guy with him. He jumped up onto the roof of the helicopter and got out his grenade and gun and said, Viet Cong, come and get me. He was so heavy he fell through the perspex. And he said he never felt so embarrassed in his whole life. His one moment of being a hero, and in real life you just fall right through, you just can't do it. That doesn't happen to John Wayne in the movies. I remember I told this to the monks the other day, one of Bob Hope's jokes. He said he can't figure out why in the movies these cowboys, they jump from an upper story window onto the horse and then they can sing a song in a normal voice afterwards. You men can understand. I know why you're going to sing in a normal voice after that. Because that's the movies, okay? That's fantasies. Real life, it doesn't work that way. So don't try and be the hero. So, and then you can actually stop the fantasy. It's basically a waste of time. If you really do want to fantasize, at least make it real. Have this real sexual fantasy or this real romantic fantasy. You know, you can meet this beautiful girl, but then she's married and she doesn't like you. Now that is a good fantasy. Have this fantasy that this heavenly being tells you the lottery number. And you buy the lottery ticket, and it's wrong. Have real fantasies. And then it's just that the whole thing just stops and you get back into real life. Anyway, do I need to be 100% complete on stage one and stage two of basic meditation method before I proceed to stage three? Can I go back and forth between two consecutive stages? Yeah, of course you can. Stage two and stage three is just an approximation. This is the reason I haven't got to stages yet in meditation because I'm trying to give the deeper stuff first of all. You know, just do nothing, just let it happen. Sit under the mango tree and these things will fall by themselves. But I'm going to tell you tomorrow, it's so hard to do nothing. You always want to do something. So tomorrow I'm going to tell you how to do something. the day afterwards, because I don't know where I am. I want to have stages. So I'll tell you the stages afterwards. And that makes you feel so much more comfortable. You know where you are. I'm stage one, stage two, I'm on stage three, and all that sort of rubbish. But, you know, it's a sort of help until you realize you don't have to be on any stages at all. Just be still and let go. And all these stages come to you. But nevertheless, it's difficult for people to get to that part. So tomorrow I'm going to be more kind to you, give you something to do so you feel happy. Yeah, I know what I'm going to do now instead of sitting here doing nothing. How do I do nothing? Just by nothing doing. Just do nothing, okay? But what am I supposed to do? Nothing. But how do I do nothing? Stop it. So tomorrow I'll give you something to do. But no, what, stage one, stage two, stage three, yeah, whatever stage you're in, just do nothing. Dear Bhante, how to control anger? What is the difference between love and metta? You can't control anger. As soon as you control it, you get more angry. So just say, it's none of my business. I'm not angry. My body's angry, my mind is not me. Nothing to do with me. So anger is like that monster who came into the emperor's palace. My favorite simile, or one of the favorite similes. Monster comes into the emperor's palace. Emperor's away, and all the people in the palace, I'll say it in full because some of you have not heard this simile, amazingly as it seems. Some of you have heard it 100 times, but there we go. This monster came into the emperor's palace. It was ugly, it was frightening, it was disgusting, and it was huge. So when people saw this, the guards and the soldiers, instead of actually protecting the palace, they went to hide. They were afraid. And allowing this monster to go right into the center of the palace and sit on the emperor's own throne. And as soon as the monster sat on there, all the people in the palace came to their senses and said, "Get out of here. Who do you think you are? This is our king's seat, not yours. Get out." And all those words of anger, all those acts of anger, even thoughts of anger, the monster just grew bigger and more ugly and more frightening and more disgusting. And that just made them even more angry. And every word of anger, every act of anger, every thought of anger, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly and more disgusting. And that had been going on a long time when the emperor came back. And this monster was huge. Now, if he was in this hall, he would take up half the hall. That's how huge this monster was. And it's ugly. I mean, the book I did, Good, Bad, Who Knows, some people call it the Good, Bad, and the Ugly book. Now, remember that used to have to be a movie? The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly? But I changed that to Good, Bad, Who Knows. So whatever, this guy was so ugly, it was so frightening to look at. You just want to put your hand over your eyes. It was so ugly. And he was so smelly. The stench coming off this monster was so bad that even the maggots crawling on his skin threw up. They vomited, they bathed. That's how much smelly he was. And the language was terrible. But the emperor was the emperor because the emperor knew what to do. When he saw this disgusting, frightening, huge monster, the emperor said, "Welcome. Thank you for coming to visit me. Why have you waited for such a long time to drop in? Has anyone got you a cup of tea yet?" And at those, yes, thank you. At least someone appreciates the amazing humour of Ajahn Brahm. Thank you so much. You can come again. And of those few kind words, the monster grew an inch bigger, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And everybody realised what the mistake was. So they started being kind to this disgusting monster. And they asked him, "Just wonder, what type of tea do you want?" "We have Dilmah tea from Sri Lanka, the very best, with condensed milk. Or would you like something healthy, like peppermint tea? Would you like something to eat? We can get you a pizza, monster size." For a monster. So they were so nice, this demon, because every kind word, every kind act, even a kind thought, the monster shrank a little bit and became less ugly and less offensive. And they kept on going with the kindness until this demon was so small. It was the same size as when he came in. But they carried on with the kindness. A couple of people gave him a foot massage. Actually, not a couple. He had such big feet, it took about 20 on each toe. And soon the demon was so tiny, one more act of kindness and the monster disappeared completely. And this was a story told by the Buddha. And he said, we call these anger-eating monsters. They feed on anger. They get bigger and more of a problem. Maybe your husband is an anger-eating monster. You get angry at him, and he gets bigger and uglier. And certainly his language gets worse. Certainly your boss at work is an anger-eating monster. So there's many anger-eating monsters in life. And so instead of giving them anger, we give them welcome. Thank you for visiting me. And it's amazing just the result of that. Things which were a big problem were a problem because you try to get rid of them. Anger itself is an anger-eating monster. I don't want to be angry. Get out of here. You get worse. Welcome anger. Or as Ajahn Chah's little technique, he told people, next time you're angry, get a clock. Put it in front of you and see how long you can be angry for. See if you can beat your record. Number one, when you put a clock in front, when you're angry, and see how long you'll be angry for. Number one, you realize it passes by itself. And number two, you objectify and you feel just how stupid I am, sitting here watching a clock, seeing how angry I can be. So that's a great way of overcoming it. And after a while, you know, why do you get angry? It's absolutely, of all human responses, it's the most stupid response of a human being. Getting angry, it doesn't help the other person. They're not going to do what you want them to do because you're getting angry at them. But it certainly kills you and makes you suffer. So it's a waste of time being angry. I said in the little book which Ping Pong is making, it's better to smile like an idiot than get angry at somebody. Getting angry at someone just doesn't work. Basically, you lost the plot if you get angry. But if you do get angry, just let it be. It'll pass by itself. Don't feed it with more anger. Don't be angry at being angry. And then it passes away. And if anyone's angry at you, just feel so much compassion for them. Oh, you must be in such a bad mood today, poor person, that you're shouting at me this way. Because you haven't caused that anger. The anger is all about them, never about you. What's the difference between love and metta? Love can be a bit attached. Metta is freeing. So as I say, the greatest act of metta is to be able to let somebody go. But for most people, love is attachment. And I often say, if you want to find out, you know, whether you love your partner or whether you've got loving kindness towards them, try this little test. You know, it's whether your love is, if it's metta, you just want them to be happy, that's all. If it's love, it's like clinging on to them. So imagine your partner, your wife, your husband, when you go back to where you came from after this retreat, you find they've left a note for you. Your partner says, I've just run off to, where's a nice place, to Las Vegas, you know, with your best friend to have a dirty weekend, a lot of sex. How would you feel? Would you be upset? My partner having sex with somebody else? That's adultery. What are they doing? If that's how you feel, it means you had love, attachment for them. But if you go back and say, oh, my partner, my husband, my wife is having such a wonderful time in Las Vegas with my best friend, having better sex than they ever had with me. Oh, I feel so uplifted. I'm so happy that they are happy because their happiness is the most important thing in the world for me. Then you know it's metta. That's the difference between love and metta. Dear Ajahn, why an enlightened person cannot tell he is enlightened? Is there a rule behind? What is the rule? Is this restriction applied to the monks only? It is applied to the monks and nuns as well, but it's usually any sensible person will not tell someone else you're enlightened. Because if you know the nun Chi Kuang, this was her teacher told her this. He said, if you ever get enlightened, don't tell anybody, because if you do, you'll have to spend the rest of your life proving it. So if I say I'm enlightened, then you go looking at me and just try and see all the faults. Now, he likes condensed milk in his tea, he can't be enlightened, or whatever it is. So really, you spend the rest of your life because trying to live up to what people think enlightenment is. And number two, the other reason why we don't, because it's too much of a pain trying to sort of meet other people's ideas of enlightenment. They haven't got a clue what enlightenment is anyway. Number two is, if you are enlightened, it is actually true that if you make an offering to an enlightened person, you get much more merit than if it's to an ordinary monk or an ordinary nun. And so because of that, people, like, they want to find out who's the enlightened monk, who's the enlightened nun, so we know where we can actually give our donations or give our food to. And the story in my first year as a monk with Wat Ajahn Chah in Thailand, the food was always disgusting. Whatever crawled or slithered on the forest floor, that's what we ate. And the only vegetables we ever had were leaves from a tree, which tasted terrible. And that was, no joke, no fruit, usually snails or frogs or rotten fish, and that was our food with sticky rice. But one day, we saw this big truck come. And in the back of the truck, there was lots and lots of pots. It came from the town, the city. Some rich person was going to give some nice food to Ajahn Chah. And he came into the dining hall. There's about 40 or 50 monks there. And the guy, the driver, came in and said, is Ajahn Chah here today? He wasn't. He was in a house doing a blessing. So the second monk, was Ajahn Liam, said, no, he's at a house diner. So the guy got in the truck and drove away. Now that really hurt. imagine your favorite food, see a truck come in here, and there's Ajahn Brahm here today, now he's over at Bodhinyana, so the food goes over there. And that's what it's like sometimes. So we don't say who is enlightened. Because otherwise, they just give food to the enlightened ones and the other ones would really sort of, suffer. So what we say in Buddhism is like someone who's enlightened from a stream winner, once return, or non-return, or an arahat, is called one of the Aryas. You've heard that before if you've read the Pali. These are the Aryas. And if we told who was an Arya and who was not in the Sangha, we'll have what I call the Aryastocracy. The elite. And there would not be like this beautiful evenness where you don't know who's enlightened and who's not. Which means you just treat every monk, every nun as the same. And that's really important to have that equality in the Sangha. So we don't have a two tiers, the ones who are enlightened and the riffraff. So it's really important. And for you too, if you get enlightened, please don't tell anybody. Maybe tell your teacher, but no one else, because it becomes too big of an ego trip. Who's enlightened and who isn't? Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, when I was about five or... Oh, this is a nice one. I'm just winding you up. When I was about 5 and 6 years old, I had a very strong feeling, memories of a past life as a Catholic nun. Not specific or clear enough to be identified. Being Australian from a small town, I said nothing to anyone because I didn't want to be thought crazy. I have now mentioned it to a few people very briefly, including Buddhists, but I have always had the feeling they're not interested or don't believe me, really. Is this okay to talk about in an interview, or should I make a longer time at the monastery? Thank you so much. Then in public, it's okay. It's quite likely that happens. 5 or 6 years of age is usually the time you remember these past lives. And usually about 7 years of age, they tend to disappear. And what you do, you remember the memory of the past. So if you want to take that further, it's quite likely that was you. And I just, what was it last I think it was last Friday. I was giving a talk about also. Oh no, it wasn't last Friday. It was the Sunday, the last Dharma class, Sutta class I gave over at Dhammaloka. Now we got on to talking about near-death experiences.